Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
This is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly look at the issues that matter to the residents of the San Joaquin Valley.
Hello, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and this is Valley Edition. On our program today, the Central Valley is known for its agriculture, but it's not just large farms or growers who are having an impact. We will share with you how a small grower and a group of kids at a charter school are both having an impact on local schools. Plus, Bakersfield versus Fresno. These two Central Valley cities have long been at odds with each other. Why a Fresno writer now has a surprisingly different view of a city known for its ag and country music. But first, strawberries and education. Roadside strawberry stands dot the San Joaquin Valley's rural roads. But how often do these vine-ripe strawberries reach school menus? A Southeast Asia farmer who grows 3 acres of strawberries in Reedley is partnering with Fresno Unified School District to bring local berries to cafeterias. FM 89's Rebecca Plevin tells us more.
Pao Sepan crouches down in his sun-drenched field. He cups a red jewel in his hand.
Whole strawberry had to be dark red.
In a few more days, his strawberries will be fully ripe. He'll pick them once they are garnet-colored from stem to tip.
We want all the strawberry full ripe and has a full flavor, 100% sugar in there.
In the past, he would sell the fresh berries at his roadside stand called Sam's Strawberry Patch. It's located at the intersection of Manning Avenue and I Street in Reedley. But this year, he will sell the bulk of his berries to the Fresno Unified School District. He says he is thrilled to share the fruits of his labor with Central Valley students.
We have farmed a long time, but this is my passion to be, farming something that feeds local.
Sepan is the first small farmer to sell his produce directly to Fresno Unified. He could pave the way for other small farmers to begin selling their produce to the school district, too.
We're in the produce and vegetable capital of, the world, and we want to take advantage of that.
That's Jose Alvarado. He is the food services director for Fresno Unified.
And we have been taking advantage of it. But now it's, taking it to another level, directly to the farmer, from the farmer, when the occasion is right and it meets our needs. But strawberries were a natural for us.
He's excited to include Sepan's berries on school menus. But he acknowledges that there are several barriers to linking farms and large school districts. For logistical reasons, he says, it's often easier for school districts to buy from large produce distributors.
Some school districts like to work with one company. It's like going to the grocery store, right? You go to one grocery store, not the cucumber stand, the broccoli stand, the strawberry stand.
He says another challenge is that some small farmers are not trained in food safety.
POW is kind of our first step to truly go to the farm. And we have worked with other farmers, but this is one where the farmer was lacking all the food safety certifications. So we're breaking new grounds with POW and learning what it takes for him to be certified.
Despite those barriers, Alvarado says there are many benefits to buying produce, and especially strawberries, from local farmers. Among those is the cost. The district serves about 85,000 meals a day. Alvarado's goal is for each of those meals to include 3 or 4 of Sepan's beauties.
A locally grown strawberry that we buy from the farmer more than likely will be more cost-effective for the district. But that's not the driver.
Beyond dollars, strawberries are one of those fruits that just taste better when they're picked fully ripe. As they say, the cost of a vine-ripened strawberry? Priceless.
The driver is that, fresh products that taste good are more likely to be than products that don't.
This farm-to-cafeteria arrangement is a great opportunity for Sepan, too. If he secures regular contracts with Fresno Unified and other larger institutions, he could soon achieve his goal of owning rather than leasing his farmland.
I wish I could own some land in the future, maybe another couple years. Right now, because with no money, the budget is tight, especially for me, and for my boy, So we still leasing all the land that we planting, but hopefully in a couple of years we have a good buyer, then we be able to buy some land.
Saipan will also continue selling berries at his stand. When I visited last Friday, a sign covered the stand's window. It read, "Sorry, we're closed." But he picked a berry directly off the vine and offered it to me.
I can try that one?
Yeah, yeah.
Ooh, thank you.
The end always has more flavor. Like this, this part is still green, so you know you might not have a good flavor yet, but yeah.
And they're nice and warm, too.
Yeah, because the sun, yeah, nice and warm, yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Fresno Unified students should start seeing Saipan's berries on the menu in May. But area residents can taste them even sooner. Saipan expects his roadside stand to open this weekend.
We're going to open in 1 week. So, you know, this safe strawberry, safe fruit, you know. So if anybody needs some, come and try it out.
Reporting from Sam's Strawberry Patch in Reedley, I'm Rebecca Plevin for Valley Public Radio.
Let me take you down.
Nice touch. Well, in an effort to increase education about agriculture and sustainability, the Fresno Grizzlies have partnered with a local charter high school to build a garden at Chukchansey Park. FM89's Ezra Romero visited the stadium, spoke with teenagers planting the garden, and has this report.
For the past week and a half, a group of seniors from Acel Charter High School in Fresno have been huffing and puffing at Chukchansey Park. But they aren't running bases or hitting pot flies. They're building and planting a garden.
We're excited most about just bringing fresh produce, you know, right here to the stadium. And so people can really see that something as simple as a garden like this can grow fresh produce, and it can grow a lot of it, and they can do it themselves.
That was Mitchell Hull, a senior at Acel and the student leader of the project. The community garden is part of the Grizzlies Farm Grown program, whose mission is to promote agricultural heritage in the San Joaquin Valley through partnerships that support education and healthy living.
Acel, well, it's literally about 500 feet from our front door, you know, to give them that platform, that area for them to take on a project and really focus on their heritage here in the valley of farming in an urban environment. It just made sense.
That's Chris Coots, media relations coordinator for the Fresno Grizzlies. The baseball team's marketing branch reached out to the school because of the project-based learning style it offers. John Minkler is a program director at Acel, which is located across Tulare Street from the stadium in the old Southern Pacific train station.
We believe students learn best by actually doing projects where they apply what they're learning in school, and doing service projects in the community that make a difference.
The baseball team hopes to foster appreciation for farming in the region. The Grizzlies Community Fund gave $1,600 to the charter school for garden construction materials, and Fresno Metro Ministry plans to help the students develop and maintain the community garden.
We are a farm team of the San Francisco Giants. We are in the farming capital of the state, of the nation, however you want to look at it. So the farm grown idea is right there.
The group of eight teenagers is planting mini gardens within the larger plot. Each raised garden box has a theme like pizza or salsa. Once a month, during baseball season, agricultural partners will come in and host a taste of the farm at Grizzly Stadium. Any produce not used will be donated to local organizations that serve the hungry or sold at minimal cost to benefit the Grizzlies Community Fund.
We wanted to do some salsa, make some homemade salsa from some of the plants, so a lot of tomatoes and peppers and garlic and that kind of thing. Also, squash and cucumbers and other produce that could be used in salads or in pizza. We were hoping to make some pizza. And so we wanted to have some food that was grown in the garden that could be shared with fans when they come on tours of the garden during the baseball season.
For the students, they're enjoying being at the stadium and a chance to come to a few games.
Yes, I'm a huge baseball fan, so I think it's really great that it's here. It's centrally located. I think it's going to draw more attention to the ballpark, and I think it'll be a good attraction for everybody to see.
The park is open to other groups showcasing agriculture products and gardens alongside the charter school's community garden, as long as they are agriculturally minded, promote good nutrition, and encourage home gardening. The current class of seniors will maintain the garden until they graduate. The Grizzlies will take care of the plot over the summer and hand over the garden to the next senior class in the fall. Ty Hernandez, a senior at ESSEL, is looking forward to see the garden in bloom.
It's nice to see that, like, what just a couple of high school students can do, and like the outcome I know is going to be really great. Just coming to the games and seeing in the back that you did this garden, I think that's going to be worth all everything we've been doing.
The garden will be unveiled on opening day at Chukchansey Park on April 4th. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Ezra Romero.
Support for Valley Edition comes from Kaiser Permanente Fresno.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you're listening to Valley Public Radio. Shortly after First Lady Michelle Obama took the stage at this year's Academy Awards, commentators from both Hollywood and inside the Beltway erupted with criticism. It was just the latest chapter in a decades-old debate about the proper role of the First Lady in contemporary society. On this edition of FM 89's commentary series, The Moral Is, Fresno State Communication Professor Diane Blair says that when it comes to public praise or criticism, it often tells us more about society as a whole than about the First Lady herself.
First Lady Michelle Obama's surprise appearance at this year's Academy Awards sparked a national media conversation about whether her presence was appropriate. Some critics accused her of selfishly crashing the event and turning an evening of entertainment into a political affair. Donnie Deutsch, a commentator for the Today Show, said, "She's what I call an uninvited guest. There was an assumptive, elitist quality to it." Washington Post columnist Jennifer Rubin argued that her appearance made the First Lady seem small and grasping. Michelle Obama's response was that it was absolutely not surprising that her appearance provoked a national conversation. "Shoot, my bangs set off a national conversation. My shoes can set off a national conversation. That's just sort of where we are." All First Ladies are well aware of the level of scrutiny their performances bring. Since the earliest days of the Republic, First Ladies have grappled with the proper performance of this unelected role that holds considerable celebrity status and public visibility. In some ways, the position is more difficult to perform than that of the president. A president is elected, and the duties of the role are spelled out in the Constitution. The First Lady is neither elected nor given any constitutional or legal guidelines to follow. She has no official duties, and yet she serves as a representative of the nation. She's in an unpaid position, and yet the role has often been a full-time job for the women who occupy it. Every First Lady faces the same dilemma. She's an individual and may have her own preferences and ambitions, but when she assumes the office of the First Lady, she also becomes a symbol of her husband's administration and American womanhood in general. Life under such scrutiny prompted Margaret Truman to say that the American people tend to treat their first family like public property, like the White House itself. Although the American public can't specifically say what they want from a First Lady, many are quick to point out what they, as individuals, don't want once she's performed an action. First ladies and the public are also aware that the role enables the women who occupy it to wield an imprecise yet significant political and cultural power. First ladies have served as political advisors, defenders of their husband's image and legacy, presidential surrogates, and advocates in their own right. Contemporary first ladies have one of the most influential podiums in the world at their disposal, and the public typically expects that they will do something useful with that platform. At the same time, first ladies who appear to exercise influence and power over their husbands' decisions, or who may perform the role in a more activist manner, have experienced harsh criticism and backlash. The public's comfort level with the first lady's activities varies greatly at any given point in time. Given the ill-defined nature of the role, what is viewed as acceptable and unacceptable may say more about our own political commitments and cultural expectations than it does about any individual first lady herself. For The Moral Is, this is Diane Blair.
The commentary series The Moral Is was produced by Valley Public Radio in association with the Bonner Center for Character Education at California State University, Fresno. The opinions expressed are those of the writer and not necessarily Valley Public Radio. Send us your comments with an email. The address is talk@kvpr.org.
You're listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. Every year, Yosemite National Park welcomes millions of visitors from around the world. Features like Half Dome and Yosemite Falls are some of the most iconic images of the Golden State. But with those crowds come problems and the age-old debate of how best to balance nature with public access. A new project from the National Park Service aims to chart a course for the management of the park and the river which runs through it. Valley Public Radio's Rebecca Plevin recently talked to Kathleen Morris, Chief of Planning for Yosemite National Park, to learn more about what changes might be in store for park visitors.
Beneath the shadows of Half Dome and El Capitan, in the heart of Yosemite Valley, lies the Merced River. It's been known as a wild and scenic river since 1987, a federal designation that aims to preserve river ecosystems and values. But after a major flood damaged much of the park's infrastructure in 1997, environmental groups and park management clashed over plans for how best to restore the park in compliance with the law. Now, after 15 years marked by lawsuits and studies, a new management plan for the Merced River has been released. The controversial proposal, known as the Merced River Plan, would not only guide the restoration efforts for decades to come, but would also result in the removal of a number of features that are popular with tourists. I recently spoke with Kathleen Morse, Chief of Planning for Yosemite, about the future of the park.
What's the big picture goal for the plan?
Really, there's two objectives that we're trying to accomplish under the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act. One is to protect the resources and the river values, which include the free-flowing condition of the river and the water quality, and a number of other values that we've identified as being outstandingly remarkable under the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act. Those include the large meadow systems, the riparian areas, the scenic quality of the park, some of the cultural and historic resources. So that's the fundamental underlying foundation for the plan. The second component, the second objective, is to provide access, to provide recreation and resource uses in the river corridor as long as they're consistent with protecting the river values.
What sorts of changes would park visitors notice?
Alternative 5 really will totally renovate the visitor experience. I mean, the main problem we have today is traffic congestion and crowding. And it's not necessarily the number of cars, the number of people that are in the valley. It's our transportation system. It's got a number of flaws in it and things that are causing gridlock and problems during peak periods. So we're addressing those issues through the preferred alternative with some transportation reroutes, some changes in the way our parking is laid out. One particular thing is a pedestrian underpass at the Yosemite Lodge and Yosemite Falls intersection. The other thing that people will notice is the visitor experience will be enhanced, and we are going to look at a lot of the areas where we have localized impacts to resources. So we have the El Capitan Meadow, where people go out to watch the climbers. And what we've got is some social trailing going on there, some fragmentation of the meadow. We want to address that with a system of boardwalks and viewing platforms that will allow the meadow to recover and still allow people to see the climbers. Another area of impact is along the river. That's the riverbanks, riparian areas between Clark's and Sentinel Bridges. We've gotten a lot of riverbank erosion, and what we want to do is restore those areas with new vegetation, with redirecting use, and so that will be a more healthy ecosystem and a more visually appealing part of the riverbank.
I understand that in some other plans there have been ideas of, you know, restricting car use or, you know, using more buses, but that sounds like that isn't in these plans, right?
The idea of mandating mass transit was explored in previous plans. The thing that you run into when you try to do that is, unlike a place like Zion, which has one entry and one exit, the park, and especially East Yosemite Valley, has many ways to get into that particular location. So you can't have a, you know, an in and out system because people are coming from all these different directions. And in many cases, they're having a through park experience. They're coming in one entry and going out another. So it's hard to have a system that would service that adequately. The second problem with mass transit in large quantities is that it's very expensive. The corridors are lengthy. So you're going to have a long transportation piece where people are going to be riding a bus for quite a period of time. You know, if you run a shuttle from a long distance, it costs quite a bit. So developing all of that is extremely expensive, and it's not very practical in a park like this. So what we've looked at doing is developing parking systems in East Yosemite Valley and outside of the park boundary to help give some pressure relief valves on those real peak days. Ultimately, we'll manage to a capacity, in the event that we exceed that parking capacity, we'll be redirecting people to other areas of the park just like we do today. We won't be relying entirely on shifting over to mass transit, but we do contemplate additional services on all the corridors. So people will have the option of taking a transit or a bus, like the YART system, into the park. They'll have that option, and it'll be increasingly available to them, but it won't be mandatory. So it's not relying on mass transit entirely. It's relying on a more sophisticated transportation system augmented by supplementary parking supply.
And I know a lot of people have focused on the services that will be eliminated. Could you talk about those and maybe how they work into this plan?
We do have a couple of things that we're trying to balance here. And one of them is just basically the footprint of the developed area in the park. And again, we're talking about East Yosemite Valley. We have a number of things that we're proposing to remove. And the ones that people have focused on have been primarily the bike rentals, the raft rentals, and the ice skating rink. We have a number of other duplicative retail operations that we're proposing to remove and some other facilities that are redundant. So we have, you know, we have extra capacity that we can eliminate and trim down. But the ones that people are most concerned about are those three. We also are proposing to eliminate day rides, horseback rides in the valley. So people ask, well, why are you doing this? You know, what's the thinking behind this? There's at least three reasons that we've had to look at these services and facilities. Number one is the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act requires us to look at major public use facilities in the river corridor and determine whether or not they're necessary. The thrust behind the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act is to remove or to not have a lot of development in the river corridor unless it's really necessary for public use. The dilemma that we run into is that in a national park, you know, what is really necessary for public use? It's a little bit different than having a simple boat access point and with a restroom and parking. I mean, there is a national park experience here that we're trying to provide. So what is necessary for that experience? So we've looked at the facilities and services in the corridor and tried to pass them through that screen. Is it really necessary? And part of what falls out in that test is those redundant services or redundant retail. You know, some is necessary, sure, but do you really need this much? So we've tried to kind of look at it through that screen. The second thing is we are dealing with the 2008 Court of Appeals decision, included a footnote that gave us a laundry list of activities and said, you know, basically they're saying, you know, you need to look at everything that's going on here and make a conscious choice about what should continue and give us some rationale for that. We just feel like there's a lot of commercial activity going on here, and they allude to it as being degradation. The last reason is that when you look at managing activity in the valley, there's such a limited amount of space between the rockfall hazard zone on one side, the river corridor on the other side, the floodplain, the meadows you're trying to protect, and the existing infrastructure, including utility corridors, there's really not a lot of room to work with. So we have to make some choice about what needs to be in place and what can be, you know, what package of services should we have in place, services and infrastructure. If you want more parking, you probably can't have more camping. If you want more camping, you can't have more lodging. So it's a trade-off thing. So we tried to look at packaging up the different things that were available in light of that limited land base we were working within.
That does seem like you're balancing a lot of different concerns and opinions. But it seems like public participation has been a really important part of this process.
Oh, it's been huge. The way we've interacted with people and the way people have interacted with us has been unprecedented in any other planning process I've ever participated in. Every step of the way, we've involved the public. We've had over 40 workshops and webinars to this point. We had an additional 15 more when the draft came out. So we feel like we've got a pretty good understanding of the perspectives out there. Doesn't mean that they're any closer to each other, that there's a clear choice, but we feel we pretty much understand the playing field. And more importantly, we feel like we've listened and we've incorporated public concerns at every stage in the process.
Well, Kathleen, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us at Valley Public Radio.
It's been enjoyable. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Well, there is a Central Valley city that was in the news this week. Stockton is now the largest city in the nation to enter Chapter 9 bankruptcy protection. As Valley Public Radio's Joe Moore reports, a federal court ruling that the city is eligible for bankruptcy sets the stage for a fresh round of negotiations with its creditors.
The judge agreed with just about every argument Stockton made, that the city was truly fiscally insolvent, and that it had negotiated in good faith.
There's nothing to celebrate about bankruptcy, but there's a certain sense of vindication.
Vindication, says city manager Bob Dice, because Stockton's Wall Street creditors had argued that the city had not negotiated in good faith. In fact, Judge Christopher Klein said it was the creditors who didn't negotiate in good faith. Now, says Dice, it's time for a new round of talks.
City of Stockton makes deals. We negotiate. We've already negotiated 10 deals. We've got a handful more, and we look forward to that opportunity.
He also says the legal challenge from the creditors has delayed the city's effort to work its way through the financial crisis.
What we should have been doing today is confirming a bankruptcy exit plan, a plan of adjustment. Instead, we just finished the first chapter of a two-chapter book.
The case was closely watched because of its potential implications on government pension payments. The creditors argued it wasn't fair for Stockton to reduce its bond debt to pennies on the dollar while maintaining its CalPERS payments in full. The judge said that's not a reason to keep Stockton out of bankruptcy, but he added, quote, "This does not mean there's not a potentially serious issue involving CalPERS." The city hopes to negotiate a plan to exit bankruptcy in the next few months. For Valley Public Radio News, I'm Joe Moore.
Historically, women have a hard time breaking into the top ranks in law enforcement, but women now head the police departments in Minneapolis, Wilmington, Delaware, and Washington, D.C. Julia Pearson now directs the Secret Service. Is the so-called brass ceiling broken? I'm Neil Conan, Women and Law Enforcement, next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation this morning at 11 on Valley Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you're listening to Valley Edition. Well, for many of us living in Fresno County, Bakersfield is just a city we drive through on our way to Disneyland or Magic Mountain. We don't much think of it as a place where there is a lot to do, or a place with a booming economy. Well, Fresno writer Gail Marshall decided to stop and spend some time there and wrote an article about her visit for Central Valley Magazine. That article sparked a lot of buzz in Bakersfield, and we hope some goodwill. Joining us now is local writer and consultant Gail Marshall. Also joining us is Nick Bilardis. He's a journalist, poet, and founder at Random Writers Workshop in Bakersfield. And Stephen Mayer with the Bakersfield Californian. Thank you all for joining me this morning.
Great to be here.
Thank you.
Okay, now we're going to do this in the spirit of fun. We're just going to say that because, first of all, I am a Bakersfield native, so there's a lot I know about. And I have to say, Gail, when you wrote this article, people always talk about Bakersfield as the place they drive through. Well, growing up in Bakersfield, my family, we didn't know anybody in Fresno. So Fresno was a city we drove through.
Exactly, exactly.
All the time. So first of all, let me ask you, Gail, what prompted you to visit Bakersfield and just really visit and spend some time there?
Well, it was actually an assignment from my very bright editors at the magazine, Carrie Norton and Valerie Bender. I had a choice of Yosemite, and the second choice was kind of a joke. And it was like, or Bakersfield. Well, I've been to Yosemite many times, and I'll always go for the place I've never been. And I realized as I looked at this, I choose Bakersfield. Absolutely, I want to see what this is about. I have never been there.
You've never... Are you really one of those folks who just passed through? You've never...
Absolutely. Absolutely. I was always in a hurry to get somewhere else, which is what actually a life lesson right there. You know, look in your own backyard for some really nice treasures. But I was always in a hurry, like a lot of people, and probably like you, on your way north. I was always on my way south, somewhere in a hurry.
And what did you, when you went, what really surprised you about what you found... Your visit?
All of it. They had me like in the beginning. I first did a crowdsourcing exercise with my Facebook friends. And I said, okay, everybody, I'm going to Bakersfield for the first time. Tell me, where should I go and what should I do? And I hit up my colleagues at the Fresno Bee. There is this migration that has happened from the Bakersfield, California to the Fresno Bee. And so we have some wonderful people who have worked and lived in Bakersfield who had ideas for me. So I just wrote everything down, and I have friends who live there. And so I just took my little list and I went down. And the first surprise I got was when I went off to a little place that was just first on the map called Coconut Joe's. And you walk in, it's a strip mall. And I thought, okay, how is this going to be? And
well, we have plenty of strip malls here in Fresno, too.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that was always my problem with going there is I really thought of Bakersfield as much like Fresno, just a little bit smaller. But and when I go somewhere for a rest or a vacation, I want someplace really different. So I pop into this little place, and it's like a little beach hut. And I got to tell you, I'm a sucker for a surprise. And so I go in, and it's typical beach food, you know, fish and chips and la-di-da like that. So I ask, like I always do, what's your specialty? What are you known for? So I got their fish and chips. I put them down. And I don't know, within 15 minutes, suddenly ukulele music pops out. This darling waiter comes up and starts singing Somewhere Under the Rainbow and serenading with a ukulele. They had me. I thought, a town that can surprise me in a strip mall cafe, I'm there. And I knew I was going to have a great day.
Well, that sounds good. Nick and Stephen, I assume that you read Gail's article in the magazine.
This is Stephen. Yes, I did.
Okay. And what were your thoughts after you read that? What did you think?
You know, it was kind of refreshing. Like Gail, in fact, like most of us here in the Southern and Central Valley, I think, you know, as a Bakersfield guy, and I was born and raised here, and I'm no spring chicken, so I've been here a long time.
I probably know you and don't know it.
Exactly. That's another nice thing about both Bakersfield and Fresno. I think you end up, they're kind of like big, small towns. But my familiarity with Fresno is really very little. You know, I think like Gail, it was a place to drive through on your way to something else. And I think that's probably true of most people in both cities. We're headed toward the Bay Area. We're headed toward Yosemite or Sequoia. We're headed toward Los Angeles or Southern California, and it's just along the road. Although certainly people in Bakersfield, you know, I hear all the time they're headed to maybe the Save Mart Center for a concert that, some act that didn't come here, or huge, base of
of sports fans who go up for the Fresno State Bulldog games, that sort of thing.
And Nick, what did you think about the article?
Well, I wasn't surprised because, well, first off, I'm not as old as Stephen. I have to say that right off the bat. Stephen doesn't give him a hard time. It made me think of rivalries between the towns and where they came from. And, it made me think of sports rivalries. It made me really miss the Fresno Falcons. It made me miss hating on the Fresno Falcons.
Okay.
Because they were such a great team to hate. But I miss that rivalry, because it's not there. And I think a lot of these rivalries come out of sports, come out of the media, come out of the idea of, hey, we're not visiting each other's cities. We don't know the people. And so it also made me think of the people I know in Fresno who I really just adore, and all the poets I know in Fresno and writers like Bonnie Hearn Hill, who appears on Valley Public Radio all the time. She was, I think she told me she was the first writer to appear as a guest on that show, Valley Writers Read. It made me think of Michael Medrano and Brian Medina, who started the longest-running open mic in the entire Central Valley. It's been running for over 10 years. And these are people who, when I go to Fresno, I stay in their homes, and when they come to Bakersfield to visit and to perform, they stay in homes over here. And when you get to know the people in the different places, and that was what was kind of darling about that article, was it talked about going to Costco, and just meeting a stranger, and you instantly start to fall in love with a place because of people.
Well, you know what? When you say that, because we all know people, who either live in Fresno or live in Bakersfield, where do you think this whole kind of rivalry kind of came from? And the fact of the matter is, and I think both cities do this, Fresnans are very bad about it. They're putting themselves down the same way as Bakersfield would do.
And who are you asking?
I'm sorry. This is Steve Mayer.
Go ahead, Stephen.
That's something I wanted to just jump into, because you're right. I think both Bakersfield and Fresno, I know certainly Bakersfield has something of an inferiority complex where, we love our city, we're proud of it. And yet sometimes folks go to the coast and they're reluctant to say, I'm from Bakersfield, because there is this, I think there's a perception, a wider perception statewide and sometimes even nationwide, that Bakersfield is kind of, whoa, it's not a great place. And certainly it has some of its faults, the air quality, sometimes very hot in the summer, but it has a ton of great assets as well. And so, I think, when that was so refreshing about Gail's piece, is it just kind of took us right to the ground level and said, hey, this is pretty cool, actually. And I mean, of course, the Californian has been talking about those assets for many years. Even Jonathan Gold, who is a Pulitzer Prize-winning food critic in Los Angeles, worked for the L.A. Weekly and now the L.A. Times, constantly writing about Luigi's Deli, Noriega Hotel, their Basque food, the Arizona Cafe, Dewar's Ice Cream and Candy Shop, Pyrenees Bakery. So, and then, of course, there's the Bakersfield Sound, which is, really world famous for kind of country music that was just not in existence previously. So
Nashville West, they always called it.
Exactly. And I think Fresno has some of those same things. It's really got a lot of assets, and most of us just don't know about it.
Thanks,
Gail.
And Gail, why don't you talk a little bit about, they talked about Bakersfield and how, and Fresno will do the same thing. People here in Fresno will do the same thing. But, I've talked to people who live here, and they absolutely love it. But in one breath, the next breath, they've got this huge complex about where they live.
We do, and it's unfortunate because we have some marvelous places here. Downtown gets better all the time. There's fresh new stores opening. If you read Bethany Clough, the Fresno Bee, she's always got some new. This food cart thing is going wild here and really developing, and wonderful theater, and as you mentioned, the sports venues. Well, as I was asking questions around about this hostility, where is this coming from? I didn't really know about it. I thought most people just sort of dismissed Bakersfield and, you know, our neighboring sister cities. We just don't appreciate them because it's like your sister, your next door neighbor. You're not appreciated in your own land. But then I heard, as Nick mentioned, this huge hostility from the sports people. Oh, my goodness. Apparently, our excellent sports teams meet up with their excellent sports teams, particularly on the high school level.
I mean, they collide.
That's what I was going to say, Nick, when you were talking about the sports rivalry. Both of my kids played high school sports. And whenever we went to Bakersfield, now, I can tell you growing up, I don't remember us being that good. But now Bakersfield is so dominant. You know, those are the teams we want to beat. And there's huge rivalry going on, especially in high school sports.
I agree. High school sports is really, you know, that's where I think a lot of the rivalry, you know, is going on. I mean, there was the big Bakersfield Taft rivalry for years, and they made a movie about it. So, you know, who knows? Maybe they'll make one about the Fresno-Bakersfield rivalry because people love rivalries. People love it. I was reading an article this morning, just kind of doing some background, and somebody had written that, you know, those moments right before the big rivalry type games, IQs drop about 50 points because it really gets ugly. And, you know, and I have to say that I contributed to all that. I was writing a blog for the Bakersfield Condors called Bobblehead on Condors. It was hockey trash talk. Mikey C., who runs the, I don't know if he's still doing it, the Dorktown podcast out of Fresno, and he had a Fresno Falcons blog, and then we had another guy who was in Las Vegas who was doing a Las Vegas Wranglers blog, and we were all, well, I was friends with all of them, and we just trash-talked each other like crazy. But it was all in jest. It was all in good fun. But people do take some of those rivalries seriously, and it's not just in sports. It's. I think we tend to put down what we don't know about. We belittle what we don't know about, what we're not willing to go out and explore on our own and to see, you know, there's so many lovely things about both cities.
You know what I would like to do, because we rarely get a chance to take calls, and with this topic, everybody's got their Bakersfield or Fresno story, and we'd really like to hear from our listeners on this. If you've got a Bakersfield or Fresno story, or why do you think, what is behind this rivalry between the two cities? We'd like to hear from you. Call us at 1-800-224-8989. We're also online at kbpr.org. Again, that's 1-800-224-8989. When we talk about this rivalry, one thing I want to pick up, we're going to take a quick break and we can come back and talk about this. Do you think part of this comes from the fact, let's kind of think about this question, that both cities, every time you turn around, we're at the bottom of some list?
You bet.
And so we're sort of at the mercy of people, again, who really don't live in either one of these cities. They don't really know anything about these cities. So they'll take a look at the stats, then they'll come back and they'll give us one of these rankings. So we're going to take a break and we'll be right back. We want to find out what you think about maybe that being part of the reason why we have this inferiority complex. I'm Anita Stevenson, and you're listening to Valley Edition. You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Anita Stevenson, and you're listening to Valley Edition. We're going to pick back up on our topic, talking about the rivalry between Bakersfield and Fresno. And, Stephen, when I left off, we were talking about perhaps these feelings that we have about our cities might come from constantly being ranked at the bottom of some list or some ranking.
Certainly that's part of it. you know, these lists seem to come out every 2 or 3 months, and you know, it's—I mean—it gets to the point where it gets ridiculous. I remember a ranking a couple of years ago, worst places to date. You know, and I think Bakersfield was near the bottom of that one.
It was.
And you know, all the single women in the newsroom were just going, "Yeah, well, it's actually kind of true." So, but some of them, you know, I wonder about their methodologies, and you know, sometimes they're kind of really the way they take these statistics and create conclusions out of them is a little bit hard for me to understand. Some of them, of course, are quite apparent. And I mentioned air quality a while back. I don't think we can argue with the issues of air quality in Fresno and Bakersfield.
Well, we can't either, but Los Angeles has bad air, too.
True. That's absolutely true. But it's a megalopolis, whereas we're not quite that big. Still, I agree. And, you know, one thing that I think one of the reasons you guys called me is I wrote a story back in May that Bakersfield is projected in 2025 to surpass Fresno in population. I think that is a fascinating statistic, because I think that's another reason Bakersfield's always been kind of like, oh, we're always the little brother to bigger Fresno. And, of course, we're surrounded on both sides by, you know, L.A. to the south and the Bay Area to the north. So, you know, if you're talking about inferiority complex, poor Bakersfield's just kind of been at the bottom of the valley and the bottom of the lists. And, you know, I think there is, it's a little bit surprising that our population now is projected to surpass Fresno and by 2050 be something like 300,000 more. So that's kind of an interesting projection.
And we felt the same way when we surpassed Sacramento. But it, you know, it remains Sacramento, and with all of its charms and problems.
You know, when you talk about that, we can talk about being at the bottom of some list, but you're talking about Bakersfield. But Bakersfield, when it comes to their economy, there have been several articles, and one recently talking about your economy. And one of the things about Bakersfield, you've always done better because you've got oil. Your economy is more diverse than Fresno. And so Bakersfield came in on these rankings in number one in a number of areas when it came to economic vitality. And, of course, your unemployment rate is lower than Fresno's at this point.
We're very fortunate in that regard, even though when you compare unemployment rates to rates nationwide, I think both Valley communities are still much higher. Ag economies tend to have higher unemployment rates, and certainly our poverty levels are high. But Bakersfield does have that edge with a quite vital oil industry that's more than 100 years old. It just really helps us to weather economic storms.
What do you think, I'm not going to say it goes unnoticed, but the fact that, just like what Gail mentioned when she went on her trip, that a lot of the good things in Bakersfield, people just don't seem to think about. It's still, you know, that little place with, you know, we're home of country music and ag that you just kind of pass through.
Yeah,
go ahead, Nick.
Yeah, Nick.
I'm going to jump in here and you know, there's a new book of poetry out by Tim Z. Hernandez, who's from the Fresno Dinuba area, and it's a poem titled Adios Fresno. And the first line of that poem is, "You could use more letters of love." And I think that kind of, people miss out on what they can experience in both cities. And I think, and I'm just going to come from the arts and cultural perspective. And, you know, you were talking about these lists, and one of those lists was the Bakersfield being the worst area for lowest literacy in the U.S. I mean, that's huge. That's awful. It's horrible. But it's actually worked a little bit in my favor, at least, in helping to bring some of the cultural arts to Bakersfield, and that's something that people can explore. So, for instance, bringing Fresno poets to Bakersfield and working with Memoir Journal, this is actually great timing. There's an anthology coming out just came out yesterday called I Speak From My Palms, and it's part of the Invisible Memoirs Project, and I've been teaching memoir classes, and in those classes I include Fresno and Bakersfield students who are telling Valley stories, stories about their lives, and they're going to start performing these stories around. Those are events that are going to take place in Bakersfield and Fresno that people can go experience these events. They can go buy the book right now on Amazon if people type in I Speak From My Poems and they go to memoirjournal.com. So I think it's, you know, Fresno has Art Hop. Bakersfield has its own arts events too. And it's things like that. It's not just the restaurants. It's going out, it's exploring the rivers in both towns and the recreational areas that, believe it or not, both towns have those kinds of things too.
Yeah.
I think it's nuts if we don't band together and promote ourselves together as an area to come and see. It gives our residents great quality of life. This is crazy for us to just like be debating over who's the worst and, you know, going on these premises that are designed by people who don't live here. Let us write these lists. Who has the most sunshiny days in a year? Then let's compare that. I think part of the reason that we don't compare well sometimes is because, as you mentioned, we have these glamorous older sisters who are beautiful and well-known.
Nice and shiny.
I mean, we're competing against San Francisco, for Pete's sake, which is one of the world's premier destinations. When you compare us with, like, generic cities from the Midwest, our visitors and friends who come love it here. We've hosted 20-some-odd exchange students from around the world. They love Fresno when they're here, and they have a great year here. And being in California, and Fresno in particular, is like a dream for them.
Well, you know, that's the whole point. Is it even fair for us to compare ourselves, just like you said, to a San Francisco or a Los Angeles because we are so different and also where we're located? Because Gail is right. When we have people who come here from like cities, they love Fresno and some of the surrounding areas. And we also shouldn't leave out the fact that we get a lot of people from Southern California coming up and enjoying our lakes and mountains and parks and that sort of thing.
I agree. I think these are Valley issues that we in the Valley that we share, we have an identity problem. And that's very much why working with students to tell their stories, to be the sort of the witnesses of their own lives, to tell their stories, it helps. It's going to help put Bakersfield and Fresno more on the map so that people can see the identity of our region, because we do have an identity and it's valuable. It's worth something. And I totally agree that when people come to visit Bakersfield, I bring a lot of writers through town. They love it. And both Bakersfield and Fresno have this mystique. And the Valley has this sort of mystique that is all its own and is an experience all its own. And the people are just wonderful. I love going to Fresno and hanging out in the Tower District and watching some poetry or just visiting with professors I know and going to some restaurants I haven't been to in Fresno and having great conversation and exploring. And that's part of our identity is the more that we can share and get to know each other, then we can build our identity together.
Stephen, I have Sue and Gail to this kind of jump in on this. How do you think, what are some ways that we can kind of work together to kind of promote ourselves?
Well, as we've been discussing this today, one of the things that's jumped into my mind is I'd like to do what Gail did and spend a day or two in Fresno, write about it, kind of give people in Bakersfield a sense of, okay, here's what you don't know. And, you know, and as you said, we have a heck of a lot in common. Why not take advantage of that? I can't write a kind of a travel story that, you know, is promoting something so much as just tell the truth and give my impressions and, you know, get a sense of what's really at street level in Fresno. What's on the outskirts? What do you see? Nick mentioned the river flowing through. There's so many things about Fresno I don't know. And so if I could learn more about Fresno and pass along some of those impressions to our readers, I'd love to do that.
Well, that's a great idea, and I love the idea of helping you do that. I'll be glad to host you while you're here part of the time. That would be fun. But I'd like you to be surprised and encourage these people who are going for the sports contests and everything. Don't just, like, go and sit in the arena. You know, take some time. Go a little early. Stay a little later. Maybe stay over. Love the Padre. And, you know, enjoy it. Don't just go there and then hurry home.
Stephen, right. I really like your idea, and I look forward to reading that article once you do complete it and get it done. And if you're in Fresno, you're going to have to stop by here, and then we can talk about that. But I think that's a great idea. That is a place to kind of get started. Or even, you know, we talk about Art Hop. I mean, let's share some of that. I'm sure they have great artists there as well. You know, there's just more. We have more. I think these two cities, even though they like to pretend that they're different, really have more in common than they think.
I totally agree.
I agree. Bakersfield artists need to go to Art Hop. They really need to do that. And I look forward to Stephen writing an article, too. You know, going to something like Respite by the River at the River Conservancy Center. That's a wonderful little place, too. That's a beautiful little Fresno gem.
It is. I really like it. And because I talked about the fact that I grew up there, but once I left, I didn't go back a lot just to visit my folks and stuff like that. But when I'd wait a few years and I'd go back and I'd be surprised at what I'd find and how much, you know, the city was growing and how much it changed. And to be honest with you, one of the things I absolutely loved is that you had a crosstown freeway. And we're kind of still struggling with that one. Really want your thoughts on, you know, I think it's really great, this article Gail did and what it sparked. And it sparked a conversation that I don't think it should end here.
I completely
agree. No, I don't think the conversation will. I'm sorry, Stephen. Go ahead.
No, you're right on, Nick. You know, I think some of what you said today is right on, and Gail, too. I think, you know, Bakersfield and Fresno, we are not really small towns. We are turning into very large cities and getting larger every year. And we still think of ourselves as kind of these small towns. And every time the LA Times writes a story about Bakersfield, it says this dusty town in the valley. I don't know why they always used to have to use the word dusty.
But that sounds more, you know, descriptive and charming if they can call us a dusty little town than a thriving place, you know.
Yeah.
They've got to have
some
place to write about.
But I think they're you know, these cities are changing, as you mentioned, and we have to reflect those changes and let readers know about them, viewers know about them, listeners know about them. And so I love the idea of kind of continuing this conversation in different ways, in the arts, in journalism, and in everyday life.
Okay. We'll all be exchange students. How about that?
I'd like that.
Well, I agree. It's something I've been doing for a few years now, and I absolutely love going to Fresno. Every time I go, and I love bringing people here. I just want to encourage people who are out there who are interested in writing memoir, I'll be teaching these classes again in the fall. I love my Fresno online students. If you're in Fresno, get a hold of me. I'd love to have you in my next sessions.
Okay, well, that's great. You all out there hear that. Nick Bilardi's a poet, journalist. Take advantage of what he has to offer. And not only that, that's a great way to exchange ideas and really get to know each other. Well, I have definitely enjoyed this conversation. I thank you all. And I thank you, Gail Marshall, for sparking this.
My pleasure. I loved it.
And so
I'm a big fan.
And so we're going to wait for some follow-ups, okay? We're going to wait for Stephen to write his article and come here, and Gail is going to host you. So we look forward to that. And thank you all for joining me. I love the conversation. Well, that is all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kbpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us at talk@kbpr.org. For audio engineer Marv Allen, production and operations manager Don Weber, Valley Edition producer Ezra Romero, and executive producer Joe Moore, I'm Juanita Stevenson. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.